one of the my favorite hashtags that I've ever used is educated hope. If I could tell everybody one thing you can do before you get pregnant, measure your baseline. So if you're treating females, you have to understand how pregnancy and postpartum and hormones and development affected them. And that's what my classes are about. That's my goal, is to get that kind of understanding into the DBT level of education. My goal is not that they perfect that exercise. Get them off that table. Get them up. I don't want them to lie down. I want them to get up. Like, that's just the beginning. We're not going to progress clams. We're gonna get them up and do something that looks like their sport. Yeah, so sharding is...
A podcast designed to help you change your mindset and your life.
It is time for something new.
Join host Dr. Shante Cofield, also known as the Movement Maestro, on a journey to see the bigger picture.
Open your eyes.
Find your passion.
And discover how movement unites us all.
Let's get it poppin'.
This is Maestro on the Mic. I'm the Maestro, and you're about to get maestrified.
3, 2, 1.
Hey guys, Maestro here, coming at you live with another episode of Maestro on the Mic. Today I have with me an incredible woman who I met, I don't know, maybe 2 years ago, and was quite possibly one of the best things to come out of going to APTA's CSM. She's been in the game for a hot minute, and we're looking at 20 plus years as a, you know, clinical physical therapist. She's changing the game as it relates to pelvic floor physical therapy. And if you follow me at all, she's a name that I've actually promoted a bunch, but she's taken a step away from the social media realm. So I was like, you know what, Julie, I got to get you on here so that my audience can hear you and hear how freaking awesome you are. So without further ado, welcome to the show, the one and only Julie Weeb.
Hello. Thank you. To let your audience.
Told you, you want to hype it up.
I'm still alive.
Exactly. I'm like, she's out there. Let's just bring her on so that they know. So thank you for taking the time, Julie. I know you're super busy. So thank
Happy
you.
Happy to take a break from studying.
Right. And we were going to get to that, you guys, because she is studying. But how about, the way that I run this is that I let the person who's on kind of intro themselves and give the folks what you want to tell them. So could you do that
for
me? Sure.
My name is Julie Weeb. I am a physical therapist, a physiotherapist, and I am a mom and a wife, and I've always worked to try to balance those things, and that doesn't always look pretty behind the scenes. But I have my own clinical practice in Los Angeles, and I also teach about how to blend sports medicine and pelvic health. And that's something, sort of a field that is really sort of starting to become a thing, which is great, but it wasn't before. There wasn't anything before. Yeah. I often get asked, where did you learn? And I was like, there was nothing mm-hmm. like that, like this back in the day. So it's really been a passion of mine to help women recover from injury and pregnancy and return them to fitness and sport. And I was always athletic myself. I really still consider myself a sports medicine PT. But after my first pregnancy, I started to blend those worlds because I wanted to get fit again. And I didn't know how the best way to do that. And so it's led to a lot of innovation and clinically and teaching. And now I am taking a little departure so that I can get my DPT. And then maybe I hope I'm just trying to hedge my bets here, but my DSC so that I can do research around female athletes and pelvic health. So that's where I'm headed. But there's some grunt work that I have got to get through. Uh-huh. So namely pharmacology is my current nemesis. So that's where I've been, and that's where I'm headed, and excited about all of it. And I've been grateful for every piece of the journey. So that's it.
I love it. Can you just elaborate a little bit more on, how do I want to phrase this? Basically your philosophy, right? Like, we had a little discussion before we hopped on here, and I feel like, you know, my world is social media, and one of the things that's been just grinding my gears about it is that I see too much, or so much, of like don't do this, or this is bad, or, you know, that provider's doing the wrong thing. And instead of people just kind of celebrating their wins and being like, this is what I stand for, this is what I believe, and this is the approach that I've, you know, evolved into over time. And I think that's what we, you know, need a bit more of. So I think I know what you're about, but could you kind of share with the folks kind of, I know, and it's a very broad question, but in terms of, you know, treatment wise, and, you know, we can kind of tailor it, I guess, or narrow it down to pelvic floor physical therapy if you want, but, or return to sport for that female athlete. What's your approach?
You know, it's funny. I think one of my favorite hashtags that I've ever used is educated hope. And I think that's probably, maybe on my tombstone, that'll be one of them. And I don't know how to make that into a noun, but like an educated, hopeful person. I don't know what it is, but what I'm hoping to do out there is to bring education that's still hopeful. Cause I think what's happened, like you said, within social media, and it's changed a lot since I started. But educated hope, I think that sort of may capture the platform that I've tried to use and promote out there, in the sense that, you know, I want women to understand more about their bodies. I think that, you know, I know for myself, when I delivered my daughter and my son, both of my pregnancies, there was some fear-based stuff that I made choices around in the midst. And I had I known X, Y, Z, I think I might have made different decisions, but there was no information back then in that regard. And I, you know, yeah, and so, yeah. So, you know, just looking at it from that perspective, like, I want women to be educated, but I think we also need to be careful on how we use the information that we have, because a lot of folks, like, I'm actually writing a blog right now, but I do.
Love it.
Yeah. But you know, how we use the information can either spark fear or it can spark hope. And so I think that it's been a little bit of a battle for me to try to help, you know, keep a balance to that kind of information. It's a fine line that we need to walk. You know, I think it's difficult to tell people you have an injury and that injury may change the way that you have to approach your fitness, but we can keep you moving. We can keep you fit, but it doesn't mean you have to give it up, but it just might have to look a little bit different depending on the level of the injury. But that's not crazy for sports medicine. Like, in sports medicine, we have people that have career-ending injuries. Yeah. It happens.
Yeah.
It sucks. Sure. And it doesn't mean that they can't ever play soccer again, but they may not be able to play at the collegiate level. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like,
sure.
Right.
Sure.
So that's not crazy talk if you're a sports medicine person, but when it comes to pelvic health, that has been crazy talk. So, like, how do we, you know, blend those two, you know, worlds? And how do we do it in a way that educates and keeps people safe, but doesn't discourage them so much and keep them fearful so that they won't continue to participate? That's where I think that's where I've tried to put myself, I guess, into that conversation.
I love that.
So, and to keep them educated, but keep them hopeful, like, that's probably.
That is awesome. And I think that we're seeing just a general trend and a move towards that, which I love, of, you know, treating a human. I think that's a big thing there, is like treating a human, understanding that psychosocial component, but not to the point where we're trying to be psychologists, but understanding that, like, educated hope, like, that is just such a succinct statement there.
Yeah. I think medicine in general it's making a big change. Like, I mean, I think, and it's not just PTs. It's like, I think, you know, a lot of my patients come to me with fear-based ideas from their physicians, unfortunately.
Yes.
And so we have a lot of work to do but I've had some really amazing progressive conversations with some physicians who are newer, that are coming into the game, who are seeing the effect of that fear. Do you know what I mean? Like, they're starting to understand
Absolutely.
The role that they have in that. And, you know, but it's funny, as I do pharmacology and knowing that for most docs, what they have to prescribe is medicine or physical therapy. Like, you know, when you think about what is it, the end result of your interaction with your physician generally is either medicine, surgery, or physical therapy. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And when you read the pharmacology text, it's like, it's kind of discouraging, you know, like some of these big diseases and, you know, that stuff. And so, you know, doctors are weighing some pretty heavy stuff, but they just don't understand how powerful their language and their authority in someone's life is. And I think that's something that we haven't, PTs too, and fitness people too, like whoever's listening, you know, we have authority in people's lives, and it's granted to us either because we have degrees, or for some of you who have high count follower counts, that is an incredible, now some of you have it legit and you should, like you, Movement Maestro, Chante, you know, have legit huge followings, but you got to wield that so wisely. And I don't happening. And it really, it's like, I actually tend to see, you know, the larger the following, the less I am impressed. Like it bums me out.
For sure. Yeah. I think that there's, you know, I love that you use that word authority in their life. And that's, I was just having this discussion yesterday. I was hanging out with Doc Jen Fit. You guys know her, I brought her on a few times, and talking about this and just what should in reality come along, the responsibility, I should say, that comes along with having a viewership like that and having, you know, I hate saying following, but having these people that do come and, you know, check in on you, check in with you and use you as a resource, and what that means, and the responsibility that you have to put out sound information and not just kind of be doing it for the likes and the numbers. And,
yeah. And that's 100%. And that's a really, I don't know how to imbue that responsibility, like how to reflect that onto some of these people that I'm like, what are you doing? You know, I mean, and that's kind of actually what this, I don't want to ruin, you know, the surprise on my blog. Oh, this is coming out after the blog, but, right. Yeah. Yeah. Sorry. That basically I did a research for one of my other class, where I was looking up, it was talking about how to create research strategies. And so I was looking up research on diastasis. I came up with, at the most, in any way I manipulated the strategy, like 18 articles. Jeez. I know, that's it. Jeez. Of those, of the ones that were relevant to the question I was asking, there was probably like 8 to 10. And some of them I could kind of extrapolate some information. But I mean, we're talking about like 8 to 10 solid articles about diastasis and exercise. So just for funsies, I Googled the same search strategy and I got 950,000 that should stop everyone in their tracks. Like that, there is no way that all of those people have read, you know, like there, and it kills me because it's big business. And, you know, I actually said, you know, you might want to take a moment and actually read the articles because it won't take you long. You know what I mean?
Exactly.
Like it's not that many articles, but so many people are just jumping on the bandwagon and they've got high followings and they fix their own diastasis or they fix their wife's diastasis or their friends. And now they have the blueprint for how to fix a diastasis. And unfortunately and the victim is people that are like the word authority, like they're looking at that person because they like the way their abdomen looks. That's all they think is important. You know, I mean, it's so manipulative and it makes me angry. Like it really does. So I don't know, educated hope and warrior, whatever, advocate. Like it kills me when people are taking advantage of folks. So 950,000. And I'll be honest with you, I did the search probably a month ago and it was a little over 900,000. And then I redid the search to write this blog this week. And it was 950.
50,000 more.
Yeah. So 50,000 more in a month. Yeah. I was like, this is cuckoo bananas.
It's a hot topic. So.
Yeah, it is. It's a hot topic. And, you know, and it's people are jumping on the bandwagon and it's great. Like, come on, let's have good voices. You know, the more the merrier. Let's get the word out, get people some educated hope, but be aware of your authority and the responsibility that you're taking with people's health.
Like, absolutely.
Because there's more to it than what's happening with the diastasis in a postpartum body. And that's what people don't understand. And they need to understand it at depth to give good advice. And it has to be individualized. It has to be individualized. Like you started to say that with your conversation with Doc Jen. And it needs to be, we need to get it. We need to understand people standing in front of us, like that individual, and apply it well. And if you do not understand that, you should not be talking about it, period.
For sure. So Julie, how does this tie in with your, and I think it does, the higher degree and, you know, the research that you're going and doing? Is this, was this thing that, something that sparked that, that
Well, no, this was some, so this is, I've already made the decision to move into this direction. And this was just one of the courses that I'm in, asked to do these research strategies. And it was like, the examples were at like, if you get 2000 responses, like, how do you then make it more relevant to what you're actually researching? And I'm like, 2000, there is nothing that I research around female athletes and pregnancy that has thousands of articles. Like, it just doesn't happen.
Right.
And that's a problem. And, and probably this has been brewing for me for a while for different reasons, like some of the ones we talked about before we got on, you know, but as it relates to what we're talking about right now, this, we have huge blind spots as it relates to the needs of women, huge blind spots because we don't research it. And, and I have had multiple conversations. It just, it's like sometimes just circumstances, conversations, reading the research, knowing that I have now, after 20 plus years of research, I mean, a clinical practice, I've just come up against too many clinical questions that I literally can't answer. I mean, I answer them innovatively in with the woman in front of me, but, you know, we still don't have answers. And I still get questions from my patients that I can't answer with evidence. I can answer with my clinical experience, and I have a lot, you know, I've done it a lot. And, but it also, you know, it's taught me to be really, measured in what I can offer and, promise and all that kind of stuff. But yeah, we just need more research, and we need females asking questions for females, because, and I'll tell you an interesting conversation I had at CSM last year, and I had already pretty much started, the wheels were turning to head this way, but it was literally like one of those like final, like, you have got to do this, Julie. Is I had a conversation with Rich Willey, and who is an amazing running researcher.
Yes.
And I had just gone to his session, and I asked him a question about this female case study that they had thrown up. And I didn't agree with some of the stuff that they had thrown up there. And he's like, well, why didn't you ask that? Like, he's really cool. You know, he's like, you should have come to the mic. And I was like, you know what? Like, I knew I was going to see you and blah, blah, blah. And so I wanted to just have more of a conversation than make it be like, you know, hey, you're wrong from the mic.
Yes,
you know,
totally.
I hate when people do that at CSM. So anyway, whatever. So we had this conversation, and I said, here's what my thoughts are and blah, blah, blah. And he was like, yeah, you know, I was kind of thinking that didn't look quite right to me either. And blah, blah. And we had this great conversation, and I said, and you know what? I bet you dollars to donuts that girl's leaking while she's running. And he's like, oh my gosh, I would never even think to ask her that question. And he basically said to me, looks like you need to start doing some, he basically was like, somebody needs to go look at that. Who better than you? He didn't exactly say that, but it was something that I knew needed to be done.
Yes.
So some exciting, and then, you know, simultaneously this really exciting opportunity came my way that's related to running research. Some new technologies out there that's going to help us understand things a little bit better. Like, it just sort of all those things all together happened in a way that I was like, okay, I got to make this happen, but I got to get the degree that helps me. You know what I mean? I got like the underlying, and you know, I want to be a nerdy professor somewhere. Like, I would love to just hang out with students and chat and guide and talk and stuff. So
I love it.
Yeah.
That's actually a perfect segue, because I want to back it up just a little bit, because you said within what you just said that, you know, about this way. And I'd love to hear more about what this way looks like, meaning what's the lifestyle? What's the, what is the word? Professional lifestyle that you're looking to move towards. Because, you know, we talked about this before we hopped on, but you guys listening, you know, I'm all about that Roger Bannister effect, in that once you see something done one time, it suddenly becomes that much more achievable or attainable for you. And part of the reason that I wanted to bring Julie on is that from minute number one, she's taken the road less traveled. That's like what Julie does. She's like, I'm going to do it this way.
Yeah.
There's rules. Okay, I see them, but like, here's how I'm going to do it. So what's the goal? What's your hope with, you know, the professional road that you're building and creating for yourself?
Well, here's the thing. Some of this, just so you know, is a complete leap of faith as well. Like,
I love it.
Pieces of this, I do not know what it's going to look like.
And I
really felt compelled, led, like, on so many levels that this was the direction I'm supposed to head. So I honestly don't know exactly what this is going to look like.
Mm-hmm.
And I do have to always acknowledge my husband in moments like this, because he is still working at the 9 to 5 to pay for me to sit around and read pharmacology while I sort of backed off a little bit on clinical practice and I backed off a little bit. I am still teaching and doing some other stuff. But anyway, so I have to acknowledge that I wouldn't be able to make this leap and try to serve women in this way if it weren't for his support. So, and my kids' support, although they tell me all the time how what they're doing is so much harder than what I'm doing. They're like, "Mom, but you're not taking European history." And I'm like, "It's graduate level pharmacology. It's hard. I get to whine. Let mommy whine." But anyway, sorry, back to your question. So I think what I would like it to look like is that I would be able to consult, be a part of this research. We have a really awesome all-female team. It's so cool. And that we would be able to just churn out, we probably have enough questions that would last us 20 years of research. Like, be able to really start investigating what the heck is going on in the pelvic floor, the vaginal vault, with diastasis, with postpartum, with pregnancy, inside athletics. Like, we have no information. I went to a thing with Kari Bowe. So anyone who is in pelvic health knows she's a huge researcher, European researcher. And she basically spent 8 hours just going through all the current research. And on, I don't know, every fifth slide, no studies on female athletes, no studies on intense exercise. Like, and I was like, okay, we have to fill that. We have to fill that. So I don't know exactly what it's going to look like, but I would like to fill that to the best. I mean, obviously I can't do it by myself. I don't mean it that way, but
No, I get you.
I want to be part of that. And I want to, like, we got to start doing it. And we now really actually have the capacity to do it in some new ways, which is awesome. And so I'm grateful for that piece of the puzzle. I would like to, I love teaching. I already do continuing education teaching, so adult ed, but I'm finding myself teaching people after they've already graduated and been in clinical practice for, you know, however many years. And if I think that the pelvic floor and the diaphragm are as important as I think they are, we should know that a lot sooner.
Yes.
In our programs. And that's not just about pelvic health. Like, that's about orthopedics and sports medicine. Yeah. There's so much that we like, I mean, because what I teach applies across all populations. I teach it in peds, neuro, pelvic health, musculoskeletal, sports. It's across all populations. And so, you know, the fact that it's still not understood in a DPT program here, so that's the doctoral level physiotherapy program here at your entry level, that you don't understand how a diastasis might affect your ability to set up, I'm putting it in air quotes, core stability. And we're still teaching about core stability in the DPT program, and you don't understand how a diastasis might affect that. That's half your population on your schedule. And you know what I mean? Like,
absolutely.
Women are on your schedule that have had pregnancies that might have diastases, and we think that about a third of them still do after 6 months to a year. That's a lot of people on your schedule that you're trying to do core stability work with, and you don't understand what a diastasis is. Like, that's a problem.
I'm going to interrupt you for a second. Sorry. Because no, you don't apologize. I'm going to interrupt you for a second because one of the problems is that a lot of people don't even know what it is. Never mind. How it's contributing to things.
Right.
A lot of people, you know, if you look at what, you know, at least what I got in terms of pelvic floor and women's health, which I hate that they were so separate, but at least we got it at NYU and they had models come in and we learned a little bit more, which got me more interested in it. Yeah. But most schools, it's like a day, if anything. And there's plenty of people that come out and are practicing for a long time that have no idea what that is. So you want to just take a few minutes and explain what it is?
What diastasis is?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's, yeah. Yeah. So basically, it's that when you have a baby, when you're pregnant, that's the abdomen splits down the middle, kind of. And there's a piece of tissue between the sides of the abdomen called the linea alba. It's fascia. So fascia is connective tissue. It's kind of like when you pull apart a chicken and all that spider webby stuff. Although everyone gets like pre-cut meat now, like no one does that anymore. But
I don't have time for that.
Yeah, I know. Give me pre-made salad and chopped up chicken. So so that it's sort of that spider webby stuff, but it's much thicker than that. But it softens and it thins during the pregnancy to allow the abdomen to expand. So it's a naturally occurring process. And so every woman, we now understand, you know, goes through some kind of separation. And over the course of the pregnancy, what we understand, I mean, I can get into it more deeply than this, but basically, for some women, the fascia doesn't regain tension again, and the abdomen doesn't regain its baseline relationship of one side to the other again, for a lot of the women. And the statistics, so this is really important. We think that depending on, and it's also how you measure diastasis. So depending mm-hmm. on what you set your bar at, we know that most women have some separation for sure by the end of pregnancy. After 6 months, we think about a third, it depends on the study, about a third of women retain a diastasis that is affecting their function. We'll say that. This new study that I'm talking about in this blog now is giving us some information about function. Like, we're actually finally getting not just how, how wide is that distance between the abs, but how is it actually affecting a woman's function with her trunk? And that's what we need to understand, not how close the diastasis is, which is what we focused on for years. So is that probably summary? Okay. Yeah. Cause there's more, 100%. There's a lot more to it, but we need to understand that it's not just it's not just the size of the gap. It's the tension of the fascia and the ability of the size of the abdomen to talk to one another and control your trunk. Like, that's kind of what we've come to finally, which is a much more, the only word I know is, I guess I'll say evolution. It's an evolution mm-hmm. of thought, which is good. And that's medicine. We all are evolving. So, but to understand that, you know, and unfortunately, most of the studies have really, like, women with small diastases. So the gap is still what we measure, which is like 2 to 3 centimeters or 4. But a normal, like, women that have never had babies, they range from 0, which is not, sorry, I can't say that because it's confusing. We'll just say from 1 millimeter to 30, oh, shoot, I'll have to plot the numbers. It's like 31 or 35 millimeters. So mm-hmm. someone who falls in that range of not nothing much to 3 centimeters is normal. Like, we think normals that they took off the street, Nelly Paris, meaning they've never had babies, they show us gaps. And I have a blog on my site. You can look at it. It's what is a normal diastasis? Because some of that's normal. Like, we have to have give there so that we can mm-hmm. eat much at Thanksgiving dinner. Like, so to be able to, you know, loosen our belts, we have to have a gap. That's important. It's there for a reason. So the idea that we need to also abolish out there is that we're trying to get people back to zero. That's not what's normal. You need it to breathe. Your tummy has to give a little bit when you take a breath. So you want some give there, and that's what it's there for. And so we need to start to re-educate people, educated hope, that, you know, getting you need to know what your baseline is. Like, if I could tell everybody one thing you can do before you get pregnant, measure your baseline so that when you're done, you're like, oh, I'm only, you know, a half a centimeter bigger than I was. I'm good. As opposed to being like, oh, I used to be 0 because that's what we think. And now I measure and I'm 3. Holy crap. You know what I mean? Like, I've already measured my daughter's. She doesn't know why.
It doesn't matter.
But I'm ready so that I can provide her hope when she's pregnant and postpartum. So I can say, oh, this is what you had when you were 16. You're good. Like,
you're good. Oh,
yeah. And then I'll be there to help her if she wants it.
Perfect.
But my goal actually initially was to change the industry and the standard of care so much that her normal recovery from pregnancy wouldn't have to necessarily involve me, in case she didn't want to hear it from her mother. So that there'd be just a world around her that it was normal to talk like this. But anyway, so we need women to understand what their baseline is and understand, you know, what then, you know, what are they left with postpartum, and is it actually functional? You know what I mean?
And
is it something that we can work with within your fitness and get you back to normal function?
That's perfect. That's perfect.
Okay. Am I still on track?
That's perfect. No, you are still 100% on track. Okay. And, you know, just to kind of summarize that, you guys, the structure versus function, like, we're not looking at a dead cadaver. And so, mm-hmm. you know, ideally medicine in general, we use that term broadly, is moving towards that and understanding that just a snapshot of something is not going to tell you how it's functioning, and is this a problem? Like, how, what's the effect? Like, it's just tells us one piece of a very big puzzle.
Absolutely.
Do you think, Julie, that you could possibly tell the listeners a simple way to measure their own diastasis or potential space?
Sure. Yes. Yeah. So, basically it's the gap between the sides of your abdomen. And the easiest place to find that is your navel. So if you put your think of the tummy muscles that they're going north south on you, you're going to put your hand east west, your fingers in your navel. Start with two or three, and then what I would do is wiggle your fingers and see if you can feel in your navel the sides of your abdomen. So you're lying on your back. Sorry. But you can do this in standing. And that's the other thing we need to talk about. Like, we need to start expanding how we're testing, because nobody lies on their back all the time, but that's where
exactly.
So exactly. Anyway, don't get me started. So anyway, if you're lying down on your back, and so this is, you're going to wiggle your fingers so you feel where the edges are at rest. And then you're going to lift your head up off the mat and feel what you're hoping to feel is that tension occurs underneath your fingers. So where you feel that empty space between the sides of the abdomen, that's your fascia, that you'll feel some tension generated there under your fingers, and that the sides of the abdomen will come and sort of pinch your fingers. That's kind of what we're shooting for. And that means that the fascia is tensioning and the walls of the abdomen are coming together to help you lift your head up. So that's like a really basic, but be aware at the navel is where most people have the least fascial tension. So if you don't feel it there, don't panic, move up a little bit. So I usually measure at the navel 1 centimeter above, 2 centimeters above, and then depending, I sometimes go higher, but that's usually when they're pregnant, because then you get like, you're running out of space.
Yeah.
And you can also do the same thing at those levels, at rest and then with a head lift. And then the other piece of the puzzle there is whether with the tension over your fascia is you want to feel it not remain like that shallow. You want it to not dig, like all of a sudden your fingers are diving toward your spine. Yes. You want some tension there. And if you're not getting it, again, let's be hopeful. One of the tricks that I use is this thing called blow before you go. So you take a breath and then exhale, blow before you start moving, and then lift and see if that changes the tension. So, and that's a really good sign for me that you have what I like to refer to as responsive fascia. So it's responsive to a stimulus and it's waking up, and that means it has some training capacity and potential. And again, don't panic if you can't feel it, because you're doing this one simple test with me trying to explain it without giving you any visual demonstration.
Yeah, for sure.
But for it sure. might be an opportunity for you to go, oh, huh, that, like, let me go get this checked out. Like,
exactly.
Use this as a springboard of education to try to find someone in your area who can help. And you can always email me and I can try to help you do that. Try to find somebody near you that has these kinds of understandings. But I'm trying to create it so that it is understood across the board with all physical therapists. That's what we were talking about, is where I'm headed. Sorry. So yes. I want to go back. I'm realizing I got to go back to the beginning and start putting this into DPT education. Like, we need our PTs when they graduate. Like, if you're a musculoskeletal therapist treating someone and you think core stability is important for their shoulder and you don't understand that they have a diastasis, like, you should understand that, like, baseline understanding so that you can test for it, measure it, and then incorporate it into your training. It's not that big a deal. It's easy to incorporate. And then you should also understand and how to evaluate pelvic floor issues. And I don't mean that internally. I just mean screenings that are external and function based. We've got those. Like, let's start making it so that it's really normal to, if you're treating females, you have to understand how pregnancy and postpartum and hormones and development affected them. And that's what my classes are about. That's my goal, is to get that kind of understanding into the DPT level of education. So I'm putting in the work so that I can go back. Because right now, you know, I don't have my degree is technically lower than I have to get a degree that at least is at the level of the people I'm teaching. So that's why I'm doing it. So pharmacology, here I come.
Putting in the footwork. I couldn't agree more, though. Education, knowledge really is power. I talk about this in terms of, you know, everyone's complaining about the healthcare model, which is pretty broken. Mm-hmm. But I wholeheartedly feel that one of the main things that we need to do, or that I'm trying to do at least, is educate the consumer. So, you know, if you don't know what good therapy looks like, you don't know that you're getting bad therapy. If you have no basic understanding of your own body, which is why I wanted you to, you know, just kind of throw out there, how can you check and see if you have a diastasis, or, you know, like, how can we do this on our own? And just educate yourself a little bit so you know, like, okay, like, my provider isn't giving me this. Maybe I should be, you know, they're not a bad person, but maybe I should be looking elsewhere for some help, because I have to be my own best advocate for things. So yes. I love that is your goal and at the heart of what you're trying to do, because education is really what's going to lift everyone up.
Yes, absolutely. And if you're a pro listening and you don't know, I'm not giving you a hard time. I didn't know when I graduated. Exactly. I didn't understand any of this stuff.
Exactly.
But I got to educate yourself. Be really proactive. Like, this is important stuff. And we're, you know, there, it's good to start to recognize. I mean, we know that women are underrepresented in most medical studies. You know, we're starting to get that. We're starting to understand that females aren't just little men. And so really short men. But, you know, and like, there's a lot of clues there that we aren't the same, but it isn't just hormonal. Like, it tends to be like, that's the explanation for everything. Yes. But there's structural differences. There's pieces of this puzzle that we can address. And part of the problem is we've made it so separate, like you mentioned. And it's so limited what we educate people on. And, you know, we have a long way to go. That's all. As long as people start, we can move away from this as oogie and, oh, we can't talk about that, or tee. I mean, it's rife. I mean, it's like, it's perfect for comedy, but poo and pee is always good for comedy. But like, once we get beyond that, and that's not just, and I'm, women listening know that I'm not making fun of you. We're all uncomfortable talking about it a little bit, but once you get through that, we're there. You know what I mean? Like, we can start talking about it like we talk about knees.
Exactly.
Like, that's what has to happen.
Like, exactly.
No different than talking about, to me at my house, in my clinic, this is no different than talking to me about your knee.
That's exactly it.
And that's what I hope becomes the standard. So here, that's what I'm saying. Like, I hope people don't think I'm trying to make
Oh, no, I doubt that anyone's feeling shamed or anything like that. Like, it's totally... Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. You guys listening, if when you did the... this is kind of ties in exactly what you're saying. If you, because I'm sure you guys listening just went to go check your own stomachs and were like, what is going on? If one or two points there, one, like I said, like Julie said, if you found something or couldn't find something, or, you know, you're concerned, I'm going to give you Julie's email and such and give you some resources there so you can go and get formally assessed. But if when you did that, it was very uncomfortable or felt weird, this is part of, and you could be a provider, and this is part, you know, it felt weird to you. Not weird like, oh, I'm injured, but weird like, I never do this. That's part of the problem within what I see, but part of the problem within the PT curriculum and within just kind of healthcare in general. One of the main things that people come in to see physiotherapists for is back pain.
Right.
One of the number one things. And yet within our DPT curriculum, we never look at the front of your body. We don't touch it. We don't talk about it. We don't assess it. We're just like, okay, your back pain. I'm going to massage your back. I'm going to touch your back. I'm going to push on your back. But I don't think it's connected to the front. And so for so many of us, touching that area is so weird and so foreign. Like, you know, I love my girl Jill Miller and all she does with her gorgeous ball. And I promote it because at least it's a way to start bringing awareness without, you know, smashing a kettlebell on your belly. To the front side of our bodies. I mean, it's super neglected. And, you know, tying into what you said, if we can get people to look at the pelvic floor, at bowel function, at their stomach, the same way that we can speak about and look at a knee, we're moving in the right direction.
Absolutely.
That much easier to treat people.
What's that?
It's going to be that much easier to treat people.
Oh, yeah. And the other piece of the puzzle that I talk a lot about is the rib cage, which is on.
Yes.
It's front and back, but we think of it more like in terms of we see it on the front because people see it working out when they're in bikinis and all that kind of stuff. And so yeah, that, but the rib cage is where the diaphragm lives, and the diaphragm is part of this whole, like the diaphragm is so interconnected with so many of the systems that we interact with as therapists, you know, and so there's just these forgotten, huge forgotten pieces of the puzzle. Like I remember this was, I don't even know how many years ago now, I was on Twitter one day or something, and some students posted a picture on a whiteboard of their discussion around gait training. And I think that they were studying for an exam or something. And it was legs. It was just legs.
That's it.
And I wrote them and I was like, where's the
rest of the body?
There might have been a pelvis, but I was like, where's the rest of the trunk and the arms? Like arm swing is part of, you know what I mean? It was just kind of funny. And I'm sure they were like, who's this jerk? But I wasn't teasing, but I was literally like, you have to see the whole picture, folks. Like we have to be able to step back and see the whole picture,
yes,
and then, and understand the totality of it. So then we can begin to see the threads into what's happening with a specific piece of that puzzle. But if you only look at the piece, you miss the big picture. And that's what we've been doing for years in medicine and in physical therapy, particularly. Like, you are not a knee. Your knee is connected to your pelvis and your foot and your shoulder. Like it's all one big system, especially if it's during a functional activity that you're getting pain. Like, you know what I mean? Like if you're getting pain in your knee when you're running, it's more than just is your quad or hamstring strong. Like we have to, or is your meniscus torn? Like we have to have other solutions than just that. And we're getting there, but I don't know what's happening inside DPT education in that regard. I mean, sorry, related to pelvic health, I do. Like, it's just still very limited. But there's a lot of warriors inside trying to make some changes there, which is great. So I just want to be one of them.
At the forefront. You dropped a little bit of a hint of this before. I just kind of want to tease that out a little bit about the fact that there are, that external pelvic floor PT is a real thing. And I think for me, you were the first person to really open my eyes to this because, and actually the episode that I just dropped yesterday, yesterday from when this is being recorded, not from when you guys are listening to this, but the episode I dropped yesterday with Dr. Tamara Robleski, she talked about, do you know her?
I think so.
She's out on the East Coast. But she, you know, we're talking about, you know, pelvic floor therapy, and she does a lot with poop. That's like her thing. That she's like, poop is the keystone of pelvic health. Like, we need to be more conceived. Loves it. But one of the things that we're talking about was trying to like kind of demystify what pelvic floor physical therapy is, because people think that if you go to a pelvic floor physical therapist, they're just going to like stick their finger inside of you and like you're going to lay on the table the whole time, which some therapists do. I'm not going to get, you know. Yeah. But, you know, I think you were one of the first people that I was exposed to that was like, hey, there's external ways. If we are trying to address the pelvic floor specifically as part of a comprehensive plan, you don't have to do everything internally. Could you talk about that a little bit, Julie?
Blow some mind. How to evaluate it or how
anything about that. That, yeah, like, hey, you can do some of this stuff externally. Like, it doesn't have to be specifics, but that it actually exists.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it's been a hard fought conversation to get external ideas at the table related to pelvic health. And that's because it was done a certain way for such a long time. And it's still, and hear this, it doesn't mean that internal work isn't valuable, which is sometimes how that gets heard. And that is not what I'm saying. But what I am saying is we need to understand the pelvic floor in context with its relationships. Yes. And I think that we understand that in other parts of the body easily. Like we've been, there's, you know, and when we're saying this about the knee, like I think that we're so beyond just quads and hamstrings for knees. Like we get how glutes and pelvis and foot affect it. But what if you get pain when you impact, like from a jump, let's say, and we know that knee dives into the center, which we think is a big deal when you're losing, you know, you lose control. Mm-hmm. We call that proximal hip and pelvic control, right? That's what that knee diving in tells us. But let's think about what's inside the pelvis, the pelvic floor. Do you know what I mean? Like that, and if they leak when they hit the ground, and the pelvic floor isn't participating well because it actually has links to some of the hip control mechanisms, you know, we need to start thinking about that. So to me, when I see someone who's coming to see me, they're a runner, they leak and they have hip pain and they do a jump for me and their knees dive in, one usually more than the other, and I know they're leaking, like I can't ignore that piece of the puzzle. The reality is when I address the incontinence piece of the puzzle alongside their hip, alongside their running, alongside like everything else I'm doing, I'm going to be able to affect all of those things simultaneously. So to me, that's an external viewpoint or a functional viewpoint of what the pelvic floor is doing. But the pelvic floor doesn't do that alone either. It doesn't control continence alone. It has relationships and teammates that it does that with. And the diaphragm and the abdomen are big fans of that relationship. And that's sort of the foundational relationship that I would treat that patient with. That interaction, I would never just treat the pelvic floor. It doesn't make sense to me. But again, I'm a sports medicine therapist. I came into this as a sports medicine therapist, and that's how you address injury in every other part of the body. You would never, you know what I mean?
With a good therapist.
Caveat. Caveat. But I guess I would say, let me say this though. I think that maybe, you know, in sports medicine, your goal is always so clear. There's so much function in your goals. Like it has to be like your sports medicine patient, your client, their goal is to go back to whatever, tennis, Zumba, soccer. Like you can't just strengthen the quad. You have to make it look like soccer. Yes. And so we just have never applied that thinking to the pelvic floor. So that's really kind of, to me, that's what I mean by external or a more functional approach or an integrative approach. Sorry, I have got something in my throat today. It's okay. So there are also then I do direct palpation to the pelvic floor, but it's all external, all through clothes. Yes. And because I also, if I'm telling you, I want to be sure that your pelvic floor is accelerating with you when you do a jump, I better have my hand there to figure out if it's, you know, you saying it does, or because some people can't feel it.
They can't tell. Yeah.
Right. And it's an interesting palpation.
For sure.
To try to do that while people are jumping, but... But I do, like I do the best that I can because I have to be able to confirm that what people are feeling, they think they're feeling is actually what's happening. Because we're dealing with women that have, you know, had vaginal deliveries and have, you know, maybe prolapse or something like that. Like I have to be sure what's happening is what we think is happening. So anyway, so external to me is also then that direct palpation, and I'm not making a quantitative analysis. I'm making a qualitative judgment call. And then over the years, I can make a like higher or lower quality assessment versus it's a 5 or a 3, which for lay, those of you listening that aren't clinicians, that's just how we measure stuff in terms of, which don't get me started on manual muscle testing. or goniometers or anything, but anyway, again, this was all to me, this was born out of necessity of there was nothing to guide women back to sport. And so trying to understand it from a more functional sports medicine standpoint, it was critical.
Totally.
There wasn't a path before.
Totally. So, yeah. You guys listening, this is what I want you guys to be thinking about, because it ties back into what we said earlier about kind of empowering the educated hope, empowering the patient, educating the patient, educating the client, educating the physical therapist, the provider also. You know, this is what therapy should look like. It should look functional. It shouldn't be, you know, Dr. Ryan Foley from ICANN, I stole this quote from him, your patient didn't get hurt on the table, they're not going to get better on the table, right? So we have to make it, isn't that great?
That's awesome.
Like
yes.
We have to get this to be functional again. And we're finally starting to see the pelvic floor being treated and understood like a knee, where we see, okay, it needs to be integrated within this comprehensive approach, this entire system, not just this one thing. And, you know, Julie's taking it a step further, I think, in making it even more approachable, even more accessible with things like external palpation, which, yeah, it is a little bit weird. You have people stuff up in your junk. But guess what? If you have a high hamstring issue or an adductor issue, it's the same thing's going on. So, you know, we need to be, as professionals, we need to make this more accessible and less, you know, weird and uncomfortable for people, so we can get them back to doing what they want to be doing, which is not laying on the PT table.
No. Right. No, it's funny because one of my courses, and this happens actually a lot, but One of the exercises that I do, they're like, well, how would you prove it? And there are table exercises that I teach because some people are in geriatrics, right? Yeah. Like they need, you know, they start somewhere too. Yeah, exactly. You got to start somewhere. And they're like, well, now where, how would you progress that exercise? And I'm like, or they, you know, they're like, okay, mm-hmm. what's, you know, I'm like, my goal is not that they perfect that exercise. Get them off that table.
That's it.
Get them up. I don't want them to lie down. I want them to get up. Like, that's just the beginning. We're not going to progress clams.
Yeah.
We're going to get them up and do something that looks like their sport. You know what I mean? And so, yes. And again, that's, and it's just, it's really, again, it's an evolution of thinking. Like, that's how we have to absorb it. And that's how I help therapists who are either in the field, will look at that as an opportunity to evolve and versus like, you know, I don't want anyone to take this negatively, but it has to be relevant and accessible. And I think that's what's been the missing piece for a lot of musculoskeletal and sports medicine folks, and even men in the field, men who are listening, you have female athletes on your schedule. And that doesn't mean that they're like competitive CrossFitters. They can be women that want to jog two to three miles a couple times a week. That's a female athlete. And they're the very typical person on people's schedules in ortho and sports medicine practices. And if you're a male therapist, you got to get some comfort around this. Yes. And if your female patient isn't comfortable with your comfort around it, have a team, have people in your office, women that you can refer to, or have a pelvic PT in your back pocket that you can, you know, collaborate with. Like, you know what I mean? Utilize,
for sure.
Build a village for your patients, know what your limits are, and be cool with that. Like, I refer out to internal PTs here in LA all the time.
There you go.
I really do. I collaborate with them. I don't want there to be this competition. Like, we got to get this person better. That's what we signed up for.
That's it.
Not to be the expert or the only one they see or whatever.
True patient-centered model. I got like two more questions for you, and then I'm going to wrap it up. But what about male issues? So, you know, because you were talking about that, you know, male therapists need to be comfortable with this because, one, they may have, they're definitely going to have female patients. They're definitely going to have patients that this directly applies to. But, you know, one of my things that I always associate you with is sharding. Not you personally, but that discussion. And like, this is a thing for men too.
Oh, that's so funny. Yeah, it's so funny to me. People are like, I was on the toilet the other day and I was thinking about it. I get that a lot. So yeah, so I love that sharding is what brings me to mind.
Like, truly, sharding.
So do you want to define what sharding is?
I would love for you to take the lead with that, Julie.
So sharding is when you have a little, you have some, what's the word? What's the best word? You have some poop. Oh, where's our friend from last week? You have some poop that comes out with your fart, like the shard. So, and the reason that you associate that for me is because that's happening for a lot of guys when they're doing things like CrossFit.
Exactly.
And that's happened with high intra-abdominal pressure moments that you end up with a toot as you go into your like major exertion, you have a fart. And it sometimes is loaded and you shart. But if it's uncontrollable for you, you know, what we're seeing there is really actually, you're having the same thing that a woman who leaks under pressure and load in a high pressure, high load situation, they leak, you fart. Like that's kind of, and so men, you know, and I think part of, you know, where you and I started having this conversation was around a conversation that I tried to have with CrossFit headquarters around this. Like, you know, if men start to recognize this is not just a female problem,
exactly,
we'll start to get a little more attention on it. You know what I mean? And we are.
It's honestly, it is bringing awareness. It's not saying that, and I think people listening will hear that. It's not that it's going to happen to every single person, but, and I think you've done a tremendous job of driving the point home that this is pelvic floor. Men and women have them. And so we need to understand that when we are either as a provider or as the person receiving care, like this is part of our body. We need to understand more of it. And it can absolutely be affected by the things that we choose to do and can be involved. And so we need to be, you know, assessing it, addressing it. I don't think that it was all, you know, your statement there was like, oh, this is going to happen and we're trying to scare tactic you. No, this is a matter of making things functional and performance-based and very relevant. Like, part of the thing that has really swung the pendulum and getting more people behind pelvic floor physical therapy and pelvic floor care and awareness is the CrossFit movement, and that people are peeing. And, you know, we saw that the pendulum go the wrong way in the beginning, and people were like, if you didn't pee, you didn't work hard enough. Oh, right. Goodness. And now it's coming back the other way. And so I think that, you know, and I think you did a great job just there. Like, this is an issue for men too. And if it is sharding, that's something that people may not know about, because it's not like going on to that. Maybe I've never seen it happen, but it's not like going onto the platform, right? It's not like coming out of people's pants where you can see it. This is one of the reasons why for women it did become an issue, because you can see it. It's like dripping onto the platform. It's people are catching it because like the sun is behind them, so they get this crazy silhouette, and it's like, what is going on there? Or, you know, women are not wearing certain colored pants anymore because of this issue.
Right.
Men can absolutely be having the same thing going on, but no one's talking about it. So it's like, yeah, let's make this a discussion. And here comes Julie Weeb, queen of sharding.
That'll be the other thing on my tombstone. Perfect.
Just to open your eyes to it. And I think that that's, you know, I think, you know, when I first met you, that was one of the things that I was like, yeah, man, here's a chick who's really making things functional. Relating it to performance, because performance is what sells. That's what I have a podcast coming out about. This, like, people don't care about prevention. Let's call a spade. I would love them to, but they don't care about prevention. People care about things after it's already happened. People care about like, oh, this will make me lift heavier or PR something. So there's nothing wrong with framing things in terms of that. Like, hey, here's how we can keep you performing the way that you are. So.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah, I agree with you 100%.
You are invaluable, Julie. You're as a resource, like.
Well, thank you.
Invaluable. Could you share with the folks some resources you have? Like, basically, how can they contact you? The courses you got on your website. What's the best way to go about, you know, getting in touch with you? Maybe where to start if they're looking at your courses. Share, promote yourself, Julie, please.
Oh, I'm not very good at that, but let's see. If you're interested in understanding a lot of these topics more, I do have online courses that go from talking just foundational type ideas to actual application to how would you ever begin to do an external pelvic floor evaluation. Those are on there. I also have clinical reasoning courses, because that's also a huge deficit, I think. In a lot of our practitioners is really understanding, like, not just what are the facts, but like, how, when, and why are you going to apply them? So there's some clinical reasoning courses on there too. I teach live. All of this is on my website. My website is julieweebpt.com.
Hey guys, Maestro here, hopping in real quick to let you know that Julie has been awesome enough to offer you guys 20% off any of the courses that you sign up for. You just got to use the code MaestroOnTheMic20. That's the number 20. One more time, MaestroOnTheMic20. The one caveat, you got to use it by May 6th. So one more time for the folks in the back, save yourself 20% by using the code MaestroOnTheMic20. It's not case sensitive, but it is time sensitive. So hop on there before May 6th and save the monies. All right, back to the show.
All of this is on my website. My website is julieweebpt.com. And so you can come hang out with me live. You can take stuff online. You can set up mentoring. I love mentoring. And I do have a clinical practice, but it is quiet right now as I try to navigate kind of making this transition. I hope to kind of open up my panel. In fact, I just did a little bit. But don't wait. Shh.
No, Julie, we just said.
Be careful. I know. I have to be careful. Yeah, I do have a wait list. But anyway, and then there was one other thing that I was going to say. Oh, I don't remember. Oh, and I blog.
That was right. Blog, yeah.
I blog. I have videos that are free too. Like, I have tons of information on there. I am not currently really that active on social media. I took a sabbatical in order to pursue this new path, because it just was too much to do all of it. But it's a resource. Like, it's still sitting there as a resource. Feel free to, like, if you miss me,
exactly,
you can go back and just pick a day. And I've tried to be generous and informative and hopeful through that medium. Multiple mediums. I'm on all the mediums, and I'm there occasionally. But the really best way to keep up with me right now is I am still actively communicating with my newsletter subscribers. So that's you know, I'm not, I don't overwhelm your inbox. I promise. I'm not one of those. But yeah, I know. I do, you know, like 2 to 3 a month at the most. And it's usually something informative. Like I try to make it always informative and helpful. But that's where I'm landing new blogs, like the one I mentioned, new videos, podcasts, and stuff like that. So if you really, if you're interested in anything related to me, that's the best way to keep up with me is to subscribe to my newsletter.
And they can do that from the website, Julie?
Yeah, it's on my homepage at the bottom.
Perfect.
Is an opportunity to do that. Yeah.
Perfect.
So, yeah.
I will link all the things for you guys. You know I always do that. I'll put all the stuff in the show notes. You don't have to worry about doing anything frantically right now. You're like driving. I'm like, oh, I gotta write it down. I will put everything in the show notes. Keep it nice and easy so you can click and then go and get all the resources, because she really is just a tremendous resource to have. Before I let you go, Julie, any yes. last words you have for the listeners?
Oh.
Uh-oh. What's going on the tombstone?
What's going on? Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. Lots of stuff apparently now. Let's just be kind and careful in how we're posting and get educated. Like be really like be aware. And I'm saying that to the folks, individuals, become educated on your bodies. Know that there are resources and people out there that want to help you. And professionals, like, you know, let's just keep learning. Let's keep staying curious, trying to figure stuff out and not be settled in our old ways of doing things and start keep looking for the new, I guess.
Always pushing the needle forward, always asking why. I love it. I love it. I love it. Julie, thank you for taking the time. I know you're extremely busy and pharmacology is just kind of breathing down your neck there. So
knocking. Where are you?
I appreciate you endlessly for taking the time. So thank you. Thank you, truly, Julie.
Thank you for having me. It's great to talk to you.
It's always good connecting. You yes. guys listening, thank you. I know you could have been doing anything, but you chose to listen to us. And for that, we are both extremely grateful. I got one more ask for you because I gotta. If you liked the episode, do me a solid, please. Give me some stars, preferably 5. If you loved it, do me an even bigger solid and subscribe. Why? Because it does help people to find the podcast. When you write stuff down, when you subscribe, it tells Apple Podcasts, hey, this is some pretty good stuff. So if you liked it, some stars. If you loved it, subscribe. All right, cutting out for real this time, guys. As always, extremely, extremely grateful. Until next time, friends, Julie Weave and Maestro,